Hello, this is Judy with the Pantograph, dated March 6, 2017. And we'll begin today with the article Quilts, Food, Auction, Highlight Mennonite Relief Sale by Lenore Sabata. Bloomington, a patchwork quilt with more than 7,500 pieces, stitched together by hand, a seven-room dollhouse wired for electric lights, and Amish-made furniture are among the many items featured in the grand auctions that are a popular part of the annual Illinois Mennonite Relief Sale. The sale will take place March 17th and 18th at the Interstate Center, 2301 West Market Street, on the west side of Bloomington. Admission and parking are free. The festivities start at 4:30 p.m. March 17 with a catfish fillet and barbecue chicken dinner. The first day's grand auction begins at 6:30 p.m. The popular all-you-can-eat pancake and sausage breakfast will go from 6 a.m. to about 11 a.m. March 18. That day's auction begins at 8:30 a.m. A special auction where children do the bidding will take place that morning. Ruthie Roth, executive secretary of the sale, said she likes everything about the sale and can't single out one thing as her favorite. This is the 59th Illinois Mennonite Relief Sale and the 59th in which Roth has been involved. Her late husband, Don Roth, who died in 2014, managed the first auction in 1959 and continued his involvement throughout his life. "I just thank God for the opportunity to help," she said. "So many are suffering in the world." 80% of the sale proceeds go to the Mennonite Central Committee of Akron, Pennsylvania, for international relief efforts. The committee helps provide food, bring clean water to communities, support families, extend friendship, and promote healthy living. The other 20% of the net proceeds go to local charities, including the Salvation Army of Peoria, Bloomington, and Pekin, Bloomington's Home Sweet Home Ministries, and the Midwest Food Bank in Bloomington and other food pantries. Roth said she will continue helping with the sale as long as God's willing. Volunteers are kept to the effort both in organizing and running the sale and in providing interns for the sale. It is a year-round task that involves more than 30 Illinois churches and 1,000 volunteers, including those who make the quilts. The Illinois Relief Sale Board quilt is a postage stamp pattern king quilt with more than 7,569 postage stamp size pieces hand-stitched by one person, an Amish woman in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, according to Roth. She said the masterpiece is in tones of blue and beige with 8 hand-quilted stitches to the inch, making it a special heirloom. It is among more than 100 quilts and wall hangings to be auctioned. In addition to the special Friday evening and Saturday morning meals, there will be meals available throughout the event, including ribeye steaks, butterfly pork chops, and hot dogs. Food also will be for sale to take home, including about 7,500 pounds of sausage packaged for sale with the help of Eureka's Bittner Meat Shop and many volunteers. The Pennsylvania Dutch Market will be filled with all kinds of pies, cakes, homemade bread, jams and jellies, cheeses and homemade noodles. Specialty booths will feature arts and crafts, flowers, books, and baby items. There will also be a kitty corner. Roth didn't know how many people attend the annual event, but she noted that organizers usually serve 2,200 to 2,300 fish dinners and about 2,800 pancake breakfasts. And that's only a portion of the people who visit the sale. An increasingly popular and growing part of the sale is 10,000 Villages, which features purses, linens, baskets, and jewelry made by more than 2,000 needy artisans in 34 countries. The program purchases the items from the artisans, providing them with income, and the proceeds from their sale goes back into the program for more trade. Continuing with the article, From Editor's Pick, Second Death Reported in Ottawa Tornado by Kevin Barlow. Bloomington. Cleanup and damage assessment continued Wednesday after Tuesday's violent storms that spawned at least 24 tornadoes across Illinois and reportedly killed four people in the Midwest, including two Ottawa men. The National Weather Service said late Wednesday the tornado that roared through Ottawa and the small village of Napleit packed winds up to 155 miles per hour, making it an EF3 on the enhanced Fujita scale. Chicago CBS affiliate WBBM reported late Wednesday night that a second Ottawa man has died of injuries suffered when a tree fell on him and another man. Authorities previously confirmed that an uprooted tree killed Wayne Tutland, 76. WBBM reported that DJ Johnson, 31, was crushed by the same tree while pushing a third man to safety. OSF St. Elizabeth Medical Center in Ottawa reported treating 16 patients after the storm that damaged dozens of structures in Ottawa and neighboring Napleit, including the LaSalle County Nursing Home in Ottawa. The types of injuries we have received include fractures and injuries to the head, knee, and arm areas, said hospital spokeswoman Libby Allison in an email. Several injuries were the result of falling tree limbs and the inability of drivers to see as they travel home. Two patients were transferred to OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria, where one was listed in critical condition and other in good condition. It was unknown late Wednesday if Johnson was one of those patients. One patient was admitted overnight at the Ottawa hospital and then released Wednesday. The others, including two patients who came to the emergency room on Wednesday, were treated and released. About a quarter of the roughly 200 homes in Napleit were damaged, Fire Chief John Nevins said. Debbie Longridge, 61, and her son were inside their Napleit home, riding out the storm in the bathtub. Firefighters rescued them after the storm and the roof was torn off. All I heard was the wind and the breaking glass, like an explosion of glass, Longridge said. Representatives from the McLean County Emergency Management Agency were ready to respond when the tornadoes hit both to the north and south of McLean County about 5 p.m. Tuesday, said Director Bob Clark. We were watching everything and were ready for deployment if necessary, but we never got the call, he said. It was an interesting situation. There were issues to the north and to the south, but we also had to keep in mind that another wave was going to arrive a few hours later. But fortunately, we weren't needed. The Weather Service has confirmed 24 tornadoes in Illinois from Tuesday's storm, including one that touched down about 5:30 p.m. in Washburn in Woodford County, but left no injuries. NWS Storm Prediction Center meteorologist Patrick March said crews are still determining how many twisters touched down across Arkansas, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Missouri. We knew McLean County was a moderate risk for severe weather, but it was just good luck that the system went to the north and south, said Weather Service meteorologist Kirk Hudel. There was some hail at about 11 p.m. along with some strong winds, but no major damage report. Marsh said in a strong storm system moved from the west mountain west and collided with warm and humid air in the Midwest, which has enjoyed an unusually warm winter and where temperatures Tuesday were well into the 70s in many places. That's why we saw storms more representative of late March and April, Marsh said. The atmosphere doesn't care what the calendar says. In southern Illinois, an apparent tornado near the town of Crossville near the Wabash River killed a 71-year-old man and injured his wife, White County Coroner Chris Marsh said. In Missouri, a twister blew several vehicles off of Interstate 55 near Perryville, 65 miles southeast of St. Louis. A 25 28-year-old man from Perryville was thrown from one of the vehicles and died. Missouri State Highway Patrol Corporal Justin Wheatley said the wind, which damaged 110 homes there and left 12 people injured, was so strong that it lifted crumpled cars from a nearby salvage yard and tossed them along the highway. American Red Cross volunteers were in several counties, including LaSalle, Marshall, and Woodford counties, to work with victims and emergency personnel. Ameren, Illinois, reported about 7 p.m. Wednesday that it had completed restoring power to 43,000 customers, mostly in the Ottawa and Carbondale areas. One of the feature stories is Demolition Imminent for Portillo's Site, by Derek Bay. Normal. A week after it was sold, the former Motel 6 at 202 Landmark Drive is on its last legs. The building was expected to come down before the end of February to make way for Bloomington Normal's first Portillo's restaurant. A demolition permit from the town of Normal could be issued any day now, said City Manager Mark Peterson. The Oak Brook-based Chicago-style hot dog chain plans to open a newly built restaurant on the site in August. I thought that timeline was very aggressive, Peterson said. We expected something would happen by now. Bloomington Landmark LLC, the developer working with Portillo's, bought the property for $3.1 million on February 28, according to county records, then took out a $2.8 million construction mortgage the same day. Portillo's will lease the site for 20 years with options for four additional five-year terms, according to county records. The chain is expected to pay $22,000 annually to Bloomington Landmark, which will receive at least $1.8 million in future sales tax revenue generated by the restaurant via the town of Normal. Bloomington Landmark is affiliated with Tartan Realty Group, the Chicago developer behind the Uptown Hyatt Place Hotel and several restaurants at College Avenue and Veterans Parkway. Tartan President Doug Rachel, who signed the lease with Portillo's, did not return a request for comment. Last month, Nick Scarpino, Vice President of Marketing and Public Relations for Portillo's, said, "Before we demolish the existing building, the Normal police and fire departments will use it to simulate emergency events." On Friday, the building had large holes in the walls and spray paint on the doors, but remained standing. The Normal fire department was doing practice drills at the building last week. Scarpino previously said the restaurant is set to have a double drive-through lane seating for 200 inside and 50 outside, a 1920s gangster theme. When Portillo's announced last April that it would come to Normal, it was expected to be the chain's first downstate location, but the company has since started construction on a Champagne restaurant to open next month. Going on to the article, State Farm reports $1.2 billion operating loss for 2016, by Lenore Sabata. Bloomington. State Farm Property Casualty Companies reported a pre-tax operating loss of $1.2 billion for 2016 in figures released Tuesday, but the company's net worth still increased. That compared to pre-tax profits of $1.9 billion in 2015 and $3.4 billion in 2014. The last time State Farm Property Casualty Companies had a pre-tax operating loss was 2011, a year when five catastrophes, including Hurricane Irene, affected results, according to State Farm spokesman Dave Phillips. The pre-tax operating loss that year was $160 million, he said. A $7 billion underwriting loss, the difference between premiums collected and claims paid, in the auto insurance business was the major contributor to the 2016 operating loss. The 2015 loss in that category was $4.4 billion. Investment and other income of $4.4 billion, an increase of $400 million over the previous year, helped offset the underwriting loss to reduce the overall operating expense. The State Farm Group ended the year with a combined net worth of $86.6 billion, which was up from the $82.7 billion at the end of 2015. Total figures for 2016 included a $5.5 billion underwriting loss on earned premiums of $61.7 billion compared to 2015's underwriting loss of $2.1 billion on earned premiums of $58.6 billion. Steve Weisbart, chief economist and senior vice president of the Insurance Information Institute, said Tuesday that State Farm's figures are in line with what other insurance companies are experiencing and are not cause for concern. State Farm in particular, and the insurance industry in general, is very capitalized, said Weisbart. Even in a year when they experience for them a small loss, it's not something to worry about. They are a company that's been around almost 100 years and have seen worse. Phillips said, "We continue to look at the future from a position of strength." He said the company takes seriously being properly prepared to meet the needs of our policyholders. 10 property casualty insurers and 2 life insurers make up State Farm Insurance operations. The auto insurance business represented 63% of the combined net written premiums of the property casualty companies. Several factors played into the underwriting loss in the auto insurance sector, according to Phillips. The number of claims and the payout on claims for property damage and medical costs from accidents had a significant impact, he said. As technology evolves, the cost to repair that technology increases, said Phillips. And as the economy has improved, people are driving more and buying vehicles with newer technology, he explained. That has been a trend in auto insurance across the country for all insurers, said Phillips. Weisbart said vehicle repair costs have been rising faster than the rate of inflation for several years, citing the increasing amount of electronics, including navigation systems and cameras. It's almost like you're driving a high-powered smartphone with some wheels on it, said Weisbart. As a higher percentage of cars on the road contain accident avoidance technology, it is hoped they help reduce the number of accidents and costly claims, he said. Company-wide State Farm auto insurance rates increased 5.1% in 2016, according to Phillips. That trend continues into this year, he said. We're not alone. Despite the hit from auto insurance, Phillips noted, some of the other lines had a good year. Homeowners, commercial multiple peril, and others in that category showed an underwriting gain of $1.6 billion. State Farm had a realized profit for the 6th year in a row in banking and for the 4th year in a row in mutual funds, said Phillips. The stock market has certainly helped with the strength of State Farm, he said. State Farm's increase in net worth, including a $4.2 billion increase related to the property casualty company's unaffiliated stock portfolio. John Farney, Senior Vice President, Treasurer, and Chief Financial Officer, said, "Our focus of putting customers first for nearly 95 years continues to underscore our position as the leader in auto and home insurance and a leader in individual life insurance." Continuing with the article, Gubert, as ag swoons, farm credit system booms. On February 28, the Agriculture Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives Appropriations Committee held a Farm Credit Administration FCA oversight hearing. Remarkably, it was the first public questioning of FCA leaders and how they regulate the nation's biggest agricultural lender, the $240 billion farm credit system, by the subcommittee in 19 years. In their intervening unchecked decades, system banks more than doubled their lending from $106 billion in 2005 to $236 billion in 2015, increased their share of U.S. ag debt by half from 23.3% in 2000 to 40.4% in early 2016, and rose to dominate ag lending. 16 of today's top 20 American ag lenders are system members. Another FCS lender is about to join that club. Beginning last summer, three system associations, AgStar Financial, the huge lender in Minnesota and western Wisconsin, Badgerland Financial, the FCS lender in Wisconsin's southern half, and First Farm Credit, the lender in western and northern Illinois, have worked to create a single association that would stretch from east of St. Louis to north of St. Paul. If the non-yet public plan is approved by association borrowers, owners, in a very quick hope-for April vote, the resulting $18 billion lender would be named Compeer Financial. It would also largely necessary, said Bert Eli, a bank consultant that writes Farm Credit Watch, a fact-filled monthly analyst of the FCS for the American Banking Association. Part of all these merger deals seems to be one-upmanship among system bankers, explains Eli in a March 1 telephone interview. Another part is that these mergers enable CEOs to pay themselves much bigger salaries, millions in the case of the proposed three-way Upper Midwest deal. I'm very skeptical, however, that any system merger leads to greater lender profits or better lender service. Eli would know. He's been analyzing and writing about the farm credit system since before its mid-1980s crackup and subsequent government bailout. Recently, he's been system banks balloon into something bigger and richer than Congress ever envisioned. The system's credit line has increased and increased to now where one member can borrow up to $1.5 billion, he relates. What farmer do you know borrows $1 billion? Clearly, it isn't meant for farmers or ranchers. Recent system lending proves Eli correct. In the last decade, several FCS bank loaned money to various non-farm businesses and corporations, including Verizon, the Cracker Barrel restaurant chain, and a car wash, according to an April 2016 Washington Post story, whose tenuous ties to agriculture seem to be the forgotten uncle of great-grandma's adopted half-sister. All this rule stretching, claims Ed Elfman, the Vice President of Congressional Relations for the American Bankers Association, violates the system's taxpayer-supported mission and allows system lenders to unfairly compete against commercial banks in local, regional, and national ag lending markets. Even worse, I think, offers Elfman. Farm Credit has doubled its lending in the past 10 years with virtually no oversight and no controls. How will it hold up if the farm economy continues to flag? System bankers quickly note that their balance sheets are solid, at least for now. What they don't talk about, however, is how their special status as a congressionally chartered lender and what Elfman and Eli both say is lax oversight by both the Farm Credit Administration and Congress allows system banks to pick big winners in big ag and big ag biz. Given the size of most of today's system loans, opens ABA Elfman, can taxpayer subsidized financing be justified for any of these massive borrowers? That's a good question for the tight-fisted Trump-bowing Congress to address in 2018 Farm Bill hearings. Before then, however, the borrower owners of the not-yet-merged Compeer Financial should ask their hired hands at AgStar, Badgerland, and First Farm Credit just how much the new bosses will be paid and how little the new deal delivers to them and their rural communities. Another article entitled, Not All United Way's Struggling Like McLean County, by Paul Switch. Bloomington, United Way of McLean County current fundraising campaign has struggled mightily, but that's not the case with neighboring United Ways. The reason for the difference is unclear. A lot of counties have a different portfolio of companies, said United Way of McLean County President David Taylor. Michael Stephen, president of Peoria-based Heart of Illinois United Way, said comparisons among United Ways is difficult because each community in United Way is different. Still, United Way of McLean County's annual fundraising campaign has declined from a high of $4.6 million in 2008 to $3.5 million in 2015-16 campaign to $1,640,403 in the 2016-17 campaign as of Thursday. 64 human service programs run by agencies such as the Community Health Care Clinic and PATH, providing access to help, rely on United Way money for support. Money from United Way helped about 36,000 people in McLean County last year. It's a different campaign from previous years, Taylor said Thursday. First, local employment is down. That accounts for part of the decline, he said. Second, some employers and employees are taking a different approach to charitable giving. For example, State Farm has changed their giving mechanism, Taylor said. They are not running a traditional United Way campaign where employees pledge a specific amount. It is a real-time donation. That's why United Way is adjusting to raising money throughout the year rather than relying on a traditional fall-winter workplace campaign. We are trying to adapt to new realities and new giving in McLean County, Taylor said. Donations from State Farm and its employees, which sometimes accounts for about half of United Way McLean County total, are down as employees are being allowed to designate a number of nonprofits, not just United Way. Our employees, agents, and customers come from all walks of life with differing viewpoints on a variety of topics, State Farm spokeswoman Missy Dundal said in January. We recognize their desire to contribute to organizations which represent their voices, and we work hard to help that happen. But other United Ways are increasing their workplace campaigns, even as they engage in more creative fundraising. Taylor clarified, workplace campaigns will continue to be an emphasis. We're looking at that in addition to creative fundraising, Taylor said. He didn't have a number of workplace campaigns because some paying campaigns are ongoing. As to creative fundraising done elsewhere, such as an obstacle course race in Macon County, Taylor said, I think any of those things are definitely under consideration. Community leaders are working on a strategic plan, not only on fundraising, but on what is our role in the community. How can we adapt to changes? Taylor said, our goal is to have it unveiled in late spring. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph, dated March 6, 2017. Please stay tuned.